വാച്വേഗം മനസ് ക്രോധവേഗം ജിഹ്വാ വേഗം ഉദരഭസ്തവേഗം ഏതാൻ വേഗാൻ യോ വിഷഹേതധീര സർവാൻ അപിമാം പൃഥിവീം സശിഷ്യാത്. The sober person who can tolerate the urge to speak, the mind's demands, the actions of anger, and the urges of the tongue, belly, and genitals is qualified to make disciples all over the world. Now Rupa Goswami, Prabhupada describes now about anger. Similarly, anger can be controlled. We cannot stop anger altogether. But if we simply become angry with those who blaspheme the Lord or the devotees of the Lord, we control our anger in Krishna consciousness. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu became angry with the miscreant brothers, Jagai and Madhai, who blasphemed and struck Nityananda Prabhu. In his Shikshastaka, Lord Chaitanya wrote, Trinadapi Sunichena, Tororapi Sishnana. One should be humbler than the grass and more tolerant than the tree. One may then ask why the Lord exhibited his anger. The point is that one should be ready to tolerate all insults to one's own self. But when Krishna or his pure devotee is blasphemed, a genuine devotee becomes angry and acts like fire against the offenders. Krodha, anger, cannot be stopped, but it can be applied rightly. It was in anger that Hanuman set fire to Lanka, but he is worshipped as the greatest devotee of Lord Ramachandra. This means that he utilized his anger in the right way. Arjuna serves as another example. He was not willing to fight, but Krishna incited his anger. You must fight. To fight without anger is not possible. Anger is controlled, however, when utilized in the service of the Lord. So if the mind is controlled, if by speaking the mind is controlled, then our thoughts will not bring us to anger, our own thoughts. Because anger will come when there is frustration, when something that we want we can't get, then we become angry. That is the natural tendency. So then here, then the idea is that if that is controlled, so far on our own account we're not getting angry. So there's no discussion of that. Is that for ourselves we are tolerant, we are peaceful, so therefore anger does not come. Because anger might come because people do not respect us. We do not get what we are hoping for, what facilities, what position, you know, what wealth, or whatever it is that we were hoping to get. Then that will create anger when that's frustrated. But for ourselves, then there's no need. If we are humble, then we understand there's something, the Lord's plan is there in some way or another. But in the case of others being dealt with improperly, then there's a question of anger. So the Prabhupada says to the real devotee, he'll become angry. And he gives so many examples here, Arjuna and Hanuman and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself. But this is for others, where in another case that someone else was wrongly dealt with, or for the Lord's purpose, then we see that the situation arose. Otherwise, it is not arising. Okay. So, any questions on this aspect of describing anger? Okay. And Prabhupada goes on to describe about the tongue. As for the urges of the tongue, we all experience that the tongue wants to eat palatable dishes. Generally, we should not allow the tongue to eat according to its choice, but should control the tongue by supplying prasad. The devotee's attitude is that he will eat only when Krishna gives him prasad. That is the way to control the urge of the tongue. One should take prasad at scheduled times and should not eat in restaurants or sweetmeat shops simply to satisfy the whims of the tongue or belly. If we stick to the principle of taking only prasad, the urges of the belly and tongue can be controlled. So these two are connected, the tongue and the belly, because generally when there's hunger, then there's desire to eat. But even if there's not so much hunger, the tongue likes to taste, as long as we're not full. The belly is full, then of course the tongue is not so interested. But if there's, you know, a neutral position, then, you know, something could be eaten, then the interest is there. So here is that whatever we want to eat that's not allowed should be regulated times and what is offered to Krishna. Then it becomes regulated. Otherwise we just eat indiscriminately. Then the tongue will just become more and more uncontrolled. And more, whatever we take, it will not be satisfying. You know, we'll want something more. So then we need to control. So this position of eating whatever Krishna gives, then that is also one of the principles. This is called amrita. Amrita means that you take without any endeavor what comes without, you know, any endeavor. That you yourself don't make any endeavor, so what comes of its own accord, that you eat. You know, so that prasadam, that comes on its own. If you accept that, then the tongue will always be controlled. But in any case, then at least the principle of regulated time, so that's one way of seeing that this is what Krishna is providing. That whatever, you know, at the scheduled times, things come to eat, then we accept those and we don't bother in between. Or sometimes if we're, you know, other situations, then whatever comes by its own accord, then one accepts that. So then this will control the tongue and the belly. In a similar matter, the urges of the genitals, the sex impulse, can be controlled when not used unnecessarily. The genitals should be used to beget a Krishna conscious child. Otherwise, they should not be used. The Krishna consciousness movement encourages marriage, but not for the satisfaction of the genitals, but for the begetting of Krishna conscious children. As soon as the children are a little grown up, they are sent to our Gurukul school in Dallas, Texas, where they are trained to become fully Krishna conscious devotees. Many such Krishna conscious children are required, and one who is capable of bringing forth Krishna conscious offspring is allowed to utilize his genitals. So you see, Lord Chaitanya, though he himself was a sannyasi, was very happy when his devotees then would have nice children, proper children. So producing children is not the problem. It's that if one is trying to enjoy the genitals without producing children, this is a problem, because that is the purpose of the genitals. We see is that we might think it very strange, like we hear about the Romans, how they used to eat. They make huge banquets and all kinds of fine delicacies, and they would eat how much they could eat. Then they would go, they had some special place, or sometimes even just arranged at the place where they were sitting. Then they would with a feather, they would tickle the back of their throat and vomit everything. And then when everything's clear, they'd rinse their mouth, everything nicely, then they would start eating again. You know, so hearing this, we think this is a waste. Food is to eat, it's for nourishing the body. Right? But in the same way, the genitals are only for producing children. That's all. Just like the filling the stomach is only for nourishment of the body, using the genitals is only for producing children. It's the same principle. The Romans didn't think it was funny. They thought it was perfectly normal. We think it's strange. Our values are different. But nowadays, people think having sex just for fun is perfectly normal. But we find in other situations, people will say this is very strange. Because if you put a male and female genital together, it produces a child. So with great difficulty, the modern culture works hard to not produce those children. They have all kinds of contraceptive methods so that children are not produced, or even if they are, then they can be destroyed. So we can see is that it's a natural thing. So using them for creating Krishna conscious children, this is fine. It is good. Krishna conscious persons are necessary. But using them otherwise, then this is not recommended. So this will be, so then he'll get into the details, I think, after this. So this tongue, belly, and genital, we see that these first three, they are connected. The mind, the speech, the mind, and anger. If the speech is proper, the mind will be peaceful, and anger also will be controlled. Otherwise, if the speech is not controlled, then we see anger comes. We can find. It's not difficult to find. Those who have a critical speech, we find they're also very easily angered. There's so many things they're angry about. Otherwise, why are they critical in their speech? Same as if we're not careful about the demands of the tongue, then that will disturb the stomach, and that will then push on the genitals. That's why they're called pushings, these six. Because they're connected, they're in a line. One is subtle, and the other is the other way. So we see the central feature is the tongue. That is described also in this prayer, Sarira Abhijajal, that the tongue, by nature, it likes to... It is the central feature. If you can control the tongue, both in its speaking and in its eating, then all the other senses are controlled. So this is basically the synopsis, you know, the Prabhupada has given on these points. Then he'll get into technically describing each one. When one is fully practiced in the methods of Krishna conscious control, he can become qualified to be a bona fide spiritual master. In his Anuvritti, explanation of Upadeshamrita, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur writes that our spiritual identification creates three kinds of urges: the urge to speak, the urge of demands of the mind, and the demands of the body. When a living entity falls victim to these three types of urges, his life becomes inauspicious. One who practices resisting these demands or urges is called tapasvi, or one who practices austerity. By such tapasya, one can overcome victimization by the material energy, the external potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So we see, as we mentioned here before, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he's who points out that these three are connected to the body, the mind, and the words. So we always see is that the position is we're trying to create a situation in which the body, the mind, and the words are engaged in Krishna's service. This is what we're trying to do. So then here, Rupa Goswami has broken those down into these six parts. So these three then become six. That the speech is one, the mind is two. That can prove means the aspect of the mind and the frustrations of the mind, which manifests as anger, and then of the body, which includes the tongue, belly, and genital. So if one can control these, then his life becomes auspicious. Otherwise it's inauspicious. One will be in being controlled by these things. Then one finds that he becomes victimized by the material energy. Means we think we're controlling, but we're actually victimized by it. Like that. That is the trick of Maya. We think we're controlling Maya and we're enjoying Maya, but actually we're being victimized by Maya. This is very subtle. So, yeah. Now he goes on to details of these things. When we refer to the urge to speak, we refer to useless talking, such as that of the impersonal Mayavadi philosophers, or of persons engaged in fruitive activities, technically called karmakanda, or of materialistic people who simply want to enjoy life without restriction. All such talks or literatures are practical exhibitions of the urge to speak. Many people are talking nonsensically and writing volumes of useless books, and all this is the result of the urge to speak. To counteract this tendency, we have to divert our talking to the subject of Krishna. This is explained in Srimad Bhagavatam 1.5, 10.11. Nayad vachas chittar padam harer yasho jagat pavitram pagrinita karhichit tadvayasham tirta ushanti manasa yayatra hamsa nirman yushikshay Yushikshaya. Those words which do not describe the glories of the Lord, who alone can sanctify the atmosphere of the whole universe, are considered by saintly persons to be like unto a place of pilgrimage of crows. Since the all-perfect persons are inhabitants of the transcendental abode, they do not derive any pleasure there. To Tadbhaga Visardago Janataga Viplavo Yasmin Pratishlokam Abhadav Bhatyapi Namanyanantasya Yashon Kitaniyat Srinbanti Gayanti Grinanti Sadhava. On the other hand, that literature which is full of descriptions of the transcendental glories of the name, fame, forms, pastimes, etc., of the unlimited Supreme Lord is a different creation, full of transcendental words directed towards bringing about a revolution in the impious lives of the world's misdirected civilization. Such transcendental literatures, even though imperfectly composed, are heard, sung, and accepted by purified men who are thoroughly honest. The conclusion is that only when we talk about devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead can we refrain from useless nonsensical talk. We should always endeavor to use our speaking power solely for the purpose of realizing Krishna consciousness. So then the two aspects is that the speaking, we need to speak. Speaking is there. It cannot be avoided. But unless our speaking is in connection to Krishna in some way or another, then it's useless. We see here that he's mentioned the Mayavadis, you know, or the philosophers, the impersonalists. He's also mentioned the Karmakandis, which are pious people who follow the Vedas. Their whole life is engaged simply in following the Vedas. And then those persons who don't follow the Vedas, who are just engaged in sinful activities for their own sense gratification. So all these are considered useless talks. So the only useful thing really is then what is connected to Krishna and Krishna's service. Whatever, if it's somehow or another connected to Krishna, then it becomes useful. You know, something for, it says, for the purpose of realizing Krishna consciousness. So whatever is necessary for realizing Krishna consciousness, that can be discussed. Otherwise, then it doesn't really have any use, it doesn't really have any good purpose. So this is the conclusion then about what is given by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur on speech. As for the agitations of the flickering mind, they are divided into two divisions. The first is called avirodha priti, or unrestricted attachment, and the other is called virodha yukta krodha, anger arising from frustration. Adherence to the philosophy of the Mayavadis, belief in the fruitive results of the karma bodies, and belief in the plans based on materialistic desires are called avirodha priti. Jnanis, karmis, and materialistic plan makers generally attract the attention of conditioned souls. But when the materialists cannot fulfill their plans, and when their devices are frustrated, they become angry. Frustration of material desires produces anger. So then, we see here is that the how you say, whatever discussions and desires are there, our attractions and our needs within this world that are based upon these three, pious, impious, or impersonal ideas, but for material purpose, then that is what is here, is the avirodha priti. Priti means one's affections. Then avirodha yukta krodha means when we're not getting these, then we become angry. So it's a very simple. We see the mind is, as we were discussing before, is quite simple. So it's hankering and lamenting, and what it's hankering about is these avirodha priti, and when it doesn't get, then there's lamentation, and then there's anger, there's disturbance like that. So it's quite a simple thing, but quite absorbing like that. It's what we have, it's what we know, so therefore it keeps us busy. So this then is the dealing with the speech, the mind, and the words. And then So any questions on this? We'll go into the other six.
The Vasamuni is quite well known for easily becoming angered. Is that a flaw in his character or it serves a particular purpose?
Both. Both. He's a yogi. And so as a yogi, then he will be in this Abhirodha Priti. You know, that'll be his position, because it includes the yogis, the karmis, and the materialists. So then he somehow or another, he's a very great person. He knows he's very controlled in his senses and very austere and powerful. Otherwise, he wouldn't be such a yogi. He wouldn't have such power. So that has to be respected. At the same time, it's also an interesting thing. Whenever he hears of anyone's good character or good fortune, he always goes to test it himself. He's heard about it from others, but he doesn't take things just on their word for it. He wants to see it himself. So then he goes and then tests them. If they're said to be very tolerant, then he goes and tests their tolerance. If they're said to be very charitable, he tests their charity. Whatever good quality they are said to have, he goes and tests it to the limit. And, you know, even beyond the limit. And if they survive that and come out and behave properly, then he's very, very pleased with them and may give so many benedictions. And that, since he's powerful, the benedictions he gives have benefit. But if the person under the, you know, undue stress doesn't somehow or another respond properly, then he'll curse them. So basically, it's an unnecessary occupational duty. You know, he has, you know, he's like a, how you say, self-proclaimed, you know, tester of the virtue of virtuous persons in the universe. So he wasn't designated. I mean, by the modes of nature, it's arranged like that. There'll always be Durvasamuni. One will always find that kind of personality. It's great for everybody else, but for the person themselves, it's not so good like that. We see that Durvasa did get benefit out of his profile when he was chased around the universe by Sudarshan Chakra, you know, and that was for 1 year. So you can imagine he was great difficulty. You know, he's like, you know, just probably just inches from death, you know, that Sudarshan is just at his back and he's just running in front. And he went everywhere and he found, one, his mystic powers can't save him. So that's obvious. And neither can anyone else in the universe save him. And even the person who owns the Sudarshan, Vishnu, says, I can't say, I can't, meaning I won't. It means you've offended the devotee, so therefore you should go to the devotee. So then going to the devotee, then he sees that because of his devotional attitude, he has such good qualities that he is not disturbed, though he naturally could be, because he is in the strong position. Durvasa, being in the stronger position, utilizes it for his own advantage. You know? And if he's pleased, he's very benevolent, but that's to his advantage also. One is it benefits the other person, but the prestige of having benefited others is then his. You know, like a wealthy man, he gives great, you know, wealth and charity, but he's known as a charitable person. So that he may lose money, but he gains in status and prestige. So it's not that it's, how you say, it's not, in one sense, it's not truly a virtue. You know, because you've just traded the one for the other. You know, or someone will be very austere for later some sense gratification. So it's still business dealing. That's why even the Vedic standards done on their own are not really so glorious. You know, I mean, they're glorious in that it's the Vedic literature, so the literature is given by the Lord, so that's good. But actually, is it still business? That's the problem. So when it's connected to the Lord, then it becomes actually glorious. You know, because you're doing it not for, you're giving in charity not because you'll get prestige, because it's your duty. You know, you're austere not because then later you'll get so much facility, But because that's your duty, that's what pleases Krishna. And then it becomes very nice. So therefore, he gets, so then what he then saw was that the power of bhakti yoga is much greater than the Astanga yoga, you know. So he was a great, powerful, he could go anywhere in the universe. So that's great power. So then after seeing this and being impressed with the power of bhakti yoga, then he went to Brahmaloka to discuss with the, you know, the devotees there, because that's where also where all the yogis go. So the yogis, they leave and go through the Shishumara to Brahmaloka. And then on Brahmaloka, they wait until the end of the life of Brahma. So then it'll be full of yogis in which he can go and discuss with. So he can discuss with them how the power of bhakti yoga is actually greater than the Astanga yoga system. So he was only benefited in that situation. So if anybody wants to take up the occupational duty of being self-proclaimed, you know, watchdog of the yatra's good qualities, it's fine. It means it's good for everybody else. But then they have to be prepared for something as severe like being chased by the Sudarshan. In other words, this person, because of his critical attitude, he will be dealt with extremely severely by the Supreme Lord. And he should not be surprised. Because he's so severe with everyone else, you add up his severity with hundreds of people and you apply it back on himself, it will be good. He'll get a serious dose of something. So now, Durvasa is very pious. He can handle it. But now whether others can handle it without becoming bitter and thinking that there's something wrong with devotional service, that's to be seen. Because criticizing devotees is extremely dangerous. Extremely dangerous. Durvasa is special, so he somehow or another survived and got the Lord's mercy. But that's only because he surrendered to the devotees, you know. So now if one is happy to all those persons once criticized, be able to go back to them and submit oneself to them, then okay, maybe one will survive quite with, you know, flying colors. But if he's not, then we can expect bitterness, solitude, you know, alienation to be one's fruit of one's, you know, self-proclaimed occupational duty. Like that. We can't expect that we are, because he is austere, you know, he is powerful in that way. And many times you find those who are critical are, because they're generally good at sadhana, they're good at knowledge, they're good at something. And they find that others aren't as good. So then they spend their time pointing out others' faults. But the problem is material austerity in that is not supreme. It's devotion is the important thing. It's their conditioned nature to do it. Durvasa's conditioned nature is to do yoga. He can do it easily. It's not a problem for him. Therefore, he must do it. But if he doesn't connect it to the Lord, then what's the use? So just because someone is more knowledgeable, more austere, more regulated, more intelligent, more thoughtful, more practical, but that's their conditioned nature. It's not them. To claim it's them, that's the foolishness. The soul is not that. It's just a manifestation of Krishna's material energy that has been given by Krishna. The potency is Krishna. It runs by Krishna's direction. How is it that man always thinks of the right things all the time? It's not him. The guy next to him can't think of anything right. It's a material energy only. By karma, they have that. So they can say, yes, I'm proud of my previous good work that I have this kind of intelligence or this kind of sadhana, but I can't claim that the intelligence and the ability to do sadhana is mine. I can't claim it. I can't even claim that the previous good work is mine. I simply had the desire to do it and Krishna sanctioned it due to some previous good desire. Like that. So the complications of karma is very great and deep, and we tend to get entangled in them, and this is our problem. But if we don't identify with it, we just acknowledge it and use it to the best of our ability in Krishna's service, then it's nice. Then there's nothing to be proud of. Like that. Because being good at something, being proud of it, then that's cheating. You know? It's not our ability. So to claim it as our own. But then that same person, if he does something stupid, will he claim it as his own? That's honest. That's a virtuous person. But generally, it'll be always someone else's fault. Anything wrong I do is someone else's fault. Anything right I do is purely mine. You know? This is the materialistic, this is the pride. But actually, what is good is actually because of the Lord's arrangement. And what's bad is because I don't have the proper desire, therefore the result ended up bad. It's the other way around. So then it's good. So, is that okay? Anything else on this?
I tend to have a tendency to
want to
anger is at the tank. That if you become angry with someone, if you're becoming even upset with someone, that makes you upset. Actually, it's meant that you have to take bath. Unless you take bath, you don't resume your real consciousness yet. So it's very contaminating being angry. So what's the fine line in between that day? Sometimes I tend to see that the devotee is rather. In the sake of being devotee angry or because somebody else is angry with a devotee in order to protect that devotee, you become angry with that devotee or another karmi or some people. But what's the fine line in between that? And you get carried away, actually you are angry for that, not for the sake of protecting devotee, but you get carried away with that anger because that's so subtle. So
Well, anger is a taste, you know, so it's a rasa. So then one may get so much taste from that. So one has to, that's the thing, is the anger must be controlled. If it's important, but it has to be used, it's applied only for the situation. You know, it's just like anything. You want to do something, like you must cook, but you can only put so much in the pot, or turn up the heat so much, or, you know, you want to do something, you want to bang a nail, then you only use a certain size hammer, you know. And you only hammer, you know, once the nail's in, you don't keep going, you know, like that. So, you know, the same way with anger. If it needs to be applied, then it's applied to get a particular work done. Once that's done, it stops. Otherwise, if it keeps going, then that means then we're trying to enjoy the anger. So that's not good. Also, one has to be very, very careful about getting involved also between the devotees. Like that, you know, that one is, you know, some argument has come up. You know, it's not, the point is one has to actually see. If there's something there, it's absolutely not Krishna conscious. But in any case, one has to be very, very careful because the situations and everything like that. Because the devotee is still considered saintly, whatever their position, you know. So then one has to be very careful of taking sides in this. You know, it's a very difficult thing. Because otherwise, if one devotee then starts criticizing another devotee, and then a third devotee criticizes that second devotee, you know, then still they're criticizing devotees. So it's a very delicate point. Best is one can avoid all that kind of thing. Because criticism, unless it will improve the situation or correct or uplift that person, it has no value. It doesn't really have a value. You know, it's like we made, like Ravinder Shroop points out, is, you know, it's like three people are in the room. One steps outside for something, then the other two just start talking about them, right? All their faults. But it doesn't do any benefit for that person that they're talking about. Neither does it really do any benefit for the two people who are discussing. It's not that they're discussing it with the idea of how to understand what's gone wrong or how to avoid it or how to help that person. It's just something to discuss because critical things give a taste. like that, you know, but while positive things may not give a taste, or we're unable to see them. So one has to be careful there in the application. But like you say, anger is polluting.
The chastisement and anger, there's a difference, isn't
there? Yes, chastisement is like here, Hanuman chastised. Because he has come, you know, as, you know, doing some work for Ram. He's a messenger. And neither are they respecting him as a messenger, and neither are they respecting Ramachandra. So this is improper. You know, one even just on the material platform. You know, one king can't disregard another king. It's against religion. It's stupid. Because it doesn't matter how small the king is today, tomorrow he may be big. So it's just stupid. It's not good politics. So it's against religion to disregard another person, let alone that other king happens to be the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Not only that, is you're disregarding, you've done something wrong. You know, it's one thing if he is, you know, Ravana is sitting there, he's doing his, running his kingdom nicely, and suddenly Ramachandra heard about it and wants to take over his kingdom. Then it's another question, but still even in that situation, one should be properly behaved. But here, Ravana stole his wife. Right? All his, it means, out of 10 heads, 9 heads tell him he should give his wife back. Right? Each of his 10 heads is means the other 9 heads are expert in a branch of Vedic knowledge. So according to that branch of Vedic knowledge, they all said, give him back or your whole dynasty will be destroyed. All his ministers said, give it back. His brother, his father, you know, everybody said. He's the only one that says he should keep her. Like that. And despite all that, then, you know, still he is being insulting. So then because of that, insulting the Supreme Lord, then Hanuman is chastising. He's not just doing it just to bother. You know, it's like the you don't see Hanuman bothering other demons. There's so many demons are there. They don't bother them. They don't bother you first. They just live theirs. They live their life. We live ours. You know. And he's not the, you know, self-proclaimed, you know, destroyer of just peaceful demons. You know. It's only when they rebel against them, you know, and create problem for devotees or directly, you know, insult or assault the Lord, then there's something there. Also Arjuna, they're there for the battle. It's not, he's not just unprovoked. So therefore it has a purpose, chastisement. So it must benefit the other person. If it doesn't benefit, then it's not really worthwhile. Then it's not service. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, Maharaj, about criticizing and offending devotees. So, just a quick question, who do we consider a devotee? And
devotee, by principle, means anyone who accepts the form of the Lord as eternal and who has chanted the holy name. That's devotee. That's the general definition. And so that creates, you know, offense. In any case, we should even avoid offending anyone. There's no need why we have to offend. You know, it means we go into the shop and, you know, do we have to offend the person because he's a karmi, you know, nonsense, rascal, demon? You know, it means even an ant must be respected, let alone devotees. Okay. We'll get there.
You mentioned earlier about criticism and offending the thing that we do, any good things that we do actually is not our credit because the Lord gave us the benediction because of our desire. So we can see the Lord in that case that he's actually, we are not doing anything basically because he is controlling everything. So if we see someone or devotee criticizing us, because is it, can we see that actually the Lord criticizing us for our behavior or due to our past activity, that we do something wrong, now we're getting some response from it?
Yeah, means we have to see is that the criticism may apply to something we're doing actually wrong. So we have to see, is it that? And if we check and we don't find that we're doing actually what they say we're doing, then it will be a reaction for something we have done. So maybe the activity's not there, but the mentality may still be there. Because if you do something and don't get corrected for it, then in the future you will get blamed for something you didn't do. Therefore we can never say we're innocent. You know, though maybe in the situation we haven't done that activity, but we know that we have done that activity in the past and didn't get corrected for it. Though we're not doing it now, the mentality will stay, because the seed will still be there. Therefore, then, Krishna is pointing out to us the improper mentality that is still residing in the heart. So in either case, either we correct our activity or correct our mentality, or both.
So if we see that the Lord's energy coming through, and then we should not even be blaming the person who is criticizing us.
No, they're just an instrument. See, is your karma, once a living entity's karma must come through another living entity. How else is it going to come? Right? It's not just going to just show up, it's going to come through another living entity. Therefore, any living entity could be used as an instrument for your karma.
It doesn't matter whether the karma is for a devotee.
No, whatever is appropriate, they'll be used. It depends upon what is being done, you know. Like this means the purpose of it, what is the result. So that person will be chosen. But they will have a mentality that matches that. Therefore, even if we receive some bad karma by the way of inappropriate behavior, but they'll use somebody, the modes of nature will use somebody who has an inappropriate mentality. Therefore, they will get a reaction also. Because they willingly took part. You don't have to take part. You know? Like that. So the modes of nature are very clever to put all these things together. You have a mentality that must be corrected. They have a mentality that matches. They're the instrument for your correction.
So our goal is to rise above it and say that this has nothing to do with us.
No, it's nothing to do with us, but we must understand that it's something to do with our consciousness. Like that. But otherwise, what's happening to the body, what's happening to the subtle body, you know, or our possessions, or, you know, family, or this or that, that's another thing. Because it's not actually us. It belongs to Krishna. So, something's to be learned. But we don't get upset with the person that's doing it, because they're not, they're just the instrument. Like that. That's all. Okay.
So Maharaj, the conclusion would be that if we do criticize someone, the bottom line is that actually we don't understand the workings of the sambandha, basically.
Basically, unless we understand that this person needs some correction and they're within the sphere of our authority, you know, authority or friendship or some way, that there's some relationship that therefore by us correcting them, it's for their benefit. But then we should be careful to see that we're doing it for their benefit, not for our own, you know, purposes.
So then in that instant, what appears to be anger or chastisement is actually concern or love.
Yeah, like that. If it's done according to, if it's appropriate, it's done according to the religious principles, then it is. And if it's not, then it won't be. It's inappropriate.
Thank you.
Like that.
Maharaj, what is the position a person should take towards non-devotees?
Means one should behave properly. Means that's always, means we're supposed to behave properly with every living entity, so let alone other humans. So proper behavior is there. We don't have to get intimate. But, you know, the proper way that we would deal and talk and, you know, like you're walking down the street, just because you're a devotee doesn't mean you don't move out of the way. You know, you walk down the street and bounce people off the sidewalk because you're a devotee and they're nonsense. The sidewalk belongs to the Brahmins, so therefore they should, you know, beat it, you know. You know, so that kind of mentality is not proper. We follow social etiquette.
And sometimes what happens with in dealing with non-devotees, you get angry. It happened with me a lot of times. You just get very angry and frustrated.
Why do you have to deal with them? I mean, why are you dealing with
just
them?
Just materialistic non-devotees. Sometimes you have to deal with them.
I'm not saying that have to is, why is that have to?
Just say in a working environment.
Okay. That you chose that environment.
Yes.
So then, you know what I'm saying? You can't. If the blame is not fully on them, you don't have to be in that environment. You could go get another job. If it is so unworkable, you could go somewhere else. Because they are who they are. Like, if you don't like dogs, you don't keep a dog. You can't expect a dog's going to change. You know, you don't like them to bark, you'd rather they sing, you know. So if you don't like barking, you don't have a dog. That's the way it is. You like singing, keep a parakeet, you know what I'm saying? So therefore you can't fully blame the others. So they're the nonsense and you're the great guy. But then if you're such a great guy, what are you doing in there, you know? You know? And then you say, well, we need the money. Why do you need the money? You know, you need the money for your attachments. They're not their attachments, they're your attachments. Right? So you've agreed to those attachments, therefore you have to take the responsibility for that. That means you have to bow your head to the material energy. You want to be pleased by the material energy, you bow your head to the material energy. It's that simple. So therefore, this is from our own viewpoint that we're saying this. Therefore, we can't really blame the others. They're just karmis. What do you want from them? You know, that's just the way they're going to behave. So if you don't like it, you don't have to follow the lifestyle that you move with them. You know? You know what I'm saying? You could always take up a different lifestyle. Either a different job or even better, get out of the whole system. You don't have to move in the materialistic system. But you've chosen to. So therefore, you can't fully blame them. We are also to blame. Therefore, we should be peaceful and tolerant. It means if you are tolerant and you're humble, then you'll get minimum trouble. Some people who are unscrupulous will take advantage. But most people aren't that malicious and vicious that they'll just bother you because you're humble, you know, or you're tolerant. Some will, but you stay away from them, you know, like that. But it's that you are intolerant or are not humble, therefore these problems come up. Right? Because you see other people are surviving, so why you're not surviving? So like this, we have to be introspective and really look at what is, you know, what is our purpose, what's behind it. We can't just say, I'm a devotee and everybody else is the nonsense. So as a devotee, I'm okay and they're all nonsense. No. As a devotee, that's good. We're devotees. But then the whole idea is we're supposed to become pure devotees. So then, what are we pure devotees? If we are, then you can, then still you have to look at it. Then Krishna's trying to tell you something. You know? But if we're not, then we can understand that we have anarthas, and therefore because of those anarthas, therefore we're running into problems. We're running into difficulties. So then you should see. It means if you're running the business and these people are bothering, so then you have to decide whether it's they're unqualified or you're not dealing with them properly. So then you go to other business people and present to them, I have this problem. And they'll tell you, well, you're not dealing right. Or, yeah, we used to have guys like that. We don't hire them anymore. Right? That's one. If you're working for somebody, then it's your business to be subservient to them. And you have to be able to work with those people that work for the person you work for. Right? They're his. And if you don't work with him, means you don't have his interest in mind. Which means you're not following the religion of working for somebody. You know, if you work for somebody, that means his business, his profit, his people, everything has to be of value to you. Otherwise, you won't do well in that environment. And neither will you move up. And someone who can deal like that, they move up. You know. And people who aren't like that, then they'll find themselves in another job. So you have to decide which it is. You know. So in either case, then there's the possibility that we have to adjust. It's much easier to adjust ourselves, one person, than to try to adjust the whole world. It's a lot more difficult. Many have tried it. You know, most of them have got themselves shot. You know, because many people don't appreciate that they're told that they have to change. So if you change yourself, it's easy. And if you can't change yourself to that environment, change yourself to a different environment. You know, if you really can't hack working with the karmas, this and that, then you shouldn't have material desires. Because material desire means you have to work with the karmas. Does that make some sense? Okay. You know, or get a job with the devotees. You know? Then you'll find out if it's the karmas or it's you. Okay.
What about the cravings or the desire to have the people like your family members or your boyfriend or something like that, people who you don't get to see all the time, and you have like this really big hankering to see them? How do you do that rising emotion? Like, is that something that you're allowed to feel? Because that can get quite strong.
Yeah, you have to you have a few levels that you have to look at. One is that it's natural if you have relationships that there'll be, you know, you will think about and be dependent upon those persons and think about those persons for the satisfaction of material exchanges. That will be natural, like that. You have connected with those persons for the purpose of exchange. So therefore you will be dependent upon them for that happiness. So then you have to see is the situation that you're in best for those relationships? You know, why are you in that situation? You know, and what does that mean? Let's say, okay, it's one thing you're going to school. Okay, and they're going to school. So then, as a student, then, if you really want to learn, then you shouldn't get too absorbed in the family or other relationships, you know, with boyfriends or with the other, because then you can't learn. The mind can, you can't do too many things at once. You can study, you know, you're either studying your book or you're studying the boys. You know, you can't really do both at once. So you have to decide which is more important. So if you're going to study the books, then you have to be able to regulate the other aspects, that those family members or those, you know, persons you want to be with, you regulate that to, okay, at this time. That's another one way to do. Regulation is how you control the mind. Okay, mind wants to see all the time, but it doesn't work anyway. And anyway, even if you marry that boy, you won't be sitting there with them all the time. Money has to be made, work has to be done in the house, you know, children have to be looked after, so you can't be with them 24 hours a day. Plus, we see, you know, sitting on the bench watching the sunset is only something people do when they're not married. Once they're married, they get down to the realities of life. You know what I'm saying? And the sunset somehow has nothing to do with it. You know, it doesn't pay the bills. That's the problem. So, therefore, then you have to look at realistically, okay, so this time I have to either be studying or this time working, and this time I can see the people. Then the mind knows, I want to see now, but okay, you can't see now, you'll see then. So if you set times and regulate everything, then you'll be able to bring the mind under control like that. Otherwise, anytime it wants, you endeavor to get, then it's uncontrolled, and actually no one will really appreciate it. Because also they have their things to do. If they're studying, suddenly you come rushing into their classroom halfway through the lecture, you won't be able to get their attention anyway. You know? So you can't do it. Or they're at their job, and then you come rushing in, and everybody, you know, turns to look, you know, who's this lady? You know, it won't, you can't interact anyway. So therefore, you set the time. At this time you see this person, at this time you do this, at this time you eat, at this time you sleep, at this time. So then the mind wants, and you say, yes, yes, you get that time. And then it can wait. You know? Like that. So that's how you control. That's one level. That then appeases the mind and the body and senses like this. But then a higher principle than this is that we understand we're not the body and the mind and the senses. But we're the soul. So therefore, then we look at it that what we have, we're in this body, we're conditioned by this body, we're conditioned by this mind, so it needs, by its nature, it needs certain things. So in the same way as then it makes it easier, it needs this, but it also needs, you have to take the whole picture, right? Like that. So you have to then find slot for everything. And then from that point, then you see, okay, this needs to be here, 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 here. And then it's done as it's supposed to be done, as a duty. Right? Then that will create better interaction. But then you can go to the next step, as you understand, is that why we're doing it this way is because that's God's direction. You know? It's God's direction. So how God wants us to do our study or be with our boyfriend, or our parents, or, you know, what we'll do with our money or our time, then that gives even more, that gives actual satisfaction. Because the other one, material satisfaction, today we're satisfied, tomorrow we're not. You can never fully actually satisfy the material situation. Like we eat today, you know, this morning, and then in the afternoon we're hungry again. So we're with the family members, and then later we want to be with them again. So you can never fully satisfy that. But the soul hankers to be satisfied because it sees that I've tried to satisfy myself through all these things, you know, for a long time, and it's not worked. So therefore, then in regulating our life, we try to connect those things to the Lord. You know? Does that make some sense? Then one can progress to a higher stage. Okay. How are we doing for time? There's not the clock on the wall.
Quarter to eight.
Okay. So, how should we keep going, or should we? Because it means you have, it means at the temple you just end class and everybody leaves. But here it's
a shot, I think we're waiting for it to come.
Oh, it hasn't come yet.
Is there some more questions?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm just saying, if Prashad's not here, then we have plenty of time. But once the Prashad comes, it takes priority. You know, devotee, the very important thing for devotees is they must have their priorities. So, any other questions, or we'll go on to the next? Yes.
Maharaj, in the Gita, Krishna asks us to do our prescribed duty. And in the Gita also, we're going to learn a lot of philosophy to understand who we are. So being a grihastha, do we have to just learn the philosophy and forget about our duty, or just concentrate on our how to learn about Krishna and pursue our duty, or do we have to do our duty and also maybe time to learn the philosophy about hand in hand?
Yeah, means one has, means in the Vedic situation, then the brahmachari before marriage, then they study and they get to understand what's actually happening. So they understand themselves, they understand the material energy, they understand the social system, how they fit into it, how everyone else fits into it, what's the interaction between it, what are the duties and responsibilities. Then after having that understanding, then that person can get married. Then, you know, continued study is there because you need to maintain, but the fundamentals are in place. So it's just deepening like that. But you can't give the same time. The student can give all day. That is their occupation. You know? So basically that's what they do. But once one is married, then one's occupation then must create one's maintenance. Like that. So then one has to balance one's study with that. If one's occupation is studying and teaching, then there's no problem. But if your occupation is not studying and teaching, then you have to fit in studying and teaching. I mean, studying within the framework. Because otherwise, why be married if you're not going to take care? Because, you know, it's not understood, right? Unless you have family members that appreciate, they themselves value that kind of a lifestyle and are able to live in a very simple, austere way. That whatever comes, you know, on its own or by some simple method, then studying may be the major thing. But then you're studying, they're studying, everything's focused around that. But if only you're studying and they're not, and they have needs and they're not being taken care of, then that's not socially balanced. It's not proper. One has to balance that.
So if you have one party not able to study, so what do the one who is studying, what to do? Do we have to go and try to pacify the other party, or?
Means it's one is here, means see, someone who studies all day, that's a brahminical activity. So if they should marry also a Brahmin, right? It has the same mentality, like that. So if one is married something else, then one has to take care of that something else. Right? Because one is married, whatever it is. You understand? So this point of, if you can study all day and in that way you're going to make your money, then great. But that means you have to be able to accommodate whatever comes, whenever it comes. Like Sudama Brahman. He studied. He didn't beg. Right? He lived by amrita, what was mentioned here, just accepting what came without asking. You know? Like that. And his wife could accommodate that. You know? For, I mean, it was no problem for her. That's what her husband's doing. That's his vow. That's her vow. You know, so they had a house that was falling apart with absolutely nothing in it. And, but somehow they're alive. You know? Means one will one, whatever one's due, one will get. So they were getting somehow or another. But the wife was finding it was too austere for the, from her view that the husband was, exposed to too much austerity. So she felt, you know, it should be, it was bothering her, not for herself, but she was considering for the husband. So then she suggested, therefore you should go to your friend Krishna. He's a big king now, and surely he'll give you something. Right? So he didn't really want to go, but the idea of going and seeing Krishna, that was nice. Plus, you know, it was his wife's desire, so to pacify his wife, and therefore then he did it, that combination. You know, it's his duty to take care, but at the same time, it's connected to Krishna. So therefore then he went. So that's the thing, is you have to see is if that's the, everybody's happy with that, then that's fine. But if everybody's not happy with that, then you have to, you bought into that family situation, therefore you have to take care of those family members, you know, to the best of your ability. And it's their duty to be satisfied with what it is. What you have to see is that what is your occupation, you know? That's the thing, is studying is nice, but, you know, your occupation you're also good at, and you like doing that occupation. So that occupation then should be performed. So it's just how much time is put into it. Does that make some sense?
So if this, if we can, that means we try to learn, because we bought into that situation only, because we moved into that with a wife or with a whatever, with another partner, then we have to get used to that lifestyle and try to put them to become Krishna conscious.
Yes, that's the duty. So you have to take care, you know, of whatever, if it's a wife or if you have a big Saint Bernard or whatever it is, you have to take care of it.
Maharaj, all of our problems, all the questions that we ask, the problems that we have, stem from the fact that we're putting ourselves in the center of the whole situation and not Krishna. So all we need to, I suppose, we just have to remember that we're the servants of the Lord, and then everything falls into place at the end of the day.
Well, that's the, as your prophet says, you don't have to change what you're doing or anything. You just have to change the consciousness from us in the center to Krishna in the center. So then instead of looking at what's best for us, we look what's best for Krishna. Mm-hmm. And we see is that we belong to Krishna, this conditioned nature belongs to Krishna, so this conditioned nature, how would it be, according to Krishna's direction, engaged? Does that make sense? It means that we see what is the conditioned nature, so then we see, okay, where does that fall in the, you know, Krishna system? You know, so then we see, oh, it's here. So what are the duties of this? Mm. And then those we do. Mm. But we do it because Krishna says we should do it, rather than because we want. Mm. So in the beginning, as we want it, we dovetail it and connect it to Krishna. But after a while, we do it because that's what's pleasing to Krishna. Mm. Like that.
So would it be correct, say, for example, recently I went through a situation where I didn't want to be working in this particular company I was working in. I wanted a change. And I said to my husband, you know, look, I just want to get out of there. I don't like this particular circumstance, da 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 da. And his instruction to me at the time was, well, you know, you're in this position now, you just stick it through and do it as that's where you're at. And so I made an attempt to change my mindset and say, okay, I'm a servant, and I happen to be in this situation at this point in time, and I just go along with whatever's presented to me, you know, in that sort of a surrendered sort of mood. And of course, it's not so difficult also because you're getting financial reward for doing what you're doing in the job. That aside, and then the situation changed. It changed. So, so many things I've done throughout my devotional life in the past few years, where I've actually wanted to instigate the change. Is it that we don't actually instigate the change, but we allow the things to happen according to the Lord's will? Or is it that we instigate the change because, you know, it's not suitable at the time?
Yeah,
is it correct to actually just allow things to happen? Would it be more proper?
One can do like that. One has to see one's... One has to take into consideration all of one's conditioned nature.
Mm.
You know, if one very much has a you know, controlling spirit, then one may have to engage that control in Krishna's service.
Mm-hmm.
you know, but then one should be getting, you know, benefit from that. So one has to see, it cannot be incongruous. Controlling means then you're taking care of others. If you are in a position to be taken care of, you can't be the controller. Does that make some sense?
Yeah.
So that's the thing, is you have to see is what is the quality, and then how you should deal with it.
To what extent do we, because say if one has a controlling nature, which I know myself I do have, to what extent do we give in to that? Is it, or well, do we say, oh, this is my nature, I keep giving into it and then never progress?
Yeah, but then the control means how, then you have to see how that control is your occupational duty. Mm. That control, okay, as a wife, what is your sphere of control? Right? What is not your sphere of control? Then you're having, you know, what duties you do. You have some, you're talking about a job. What does that job mean? Is it your job or is it someone else's job? You know, if it's your job, then naturally controlling is going to be more prominent. If it's someone else's job and you're working at it, that means then it may, you have to see what's appropriate. Or you find a job where you are controlling things. You know, as a supervisor, then you're controlling things, or, you know, you go out and whatever, a forester, and then you control of, you know, 1,000 acres of trees, so you can, you know, tell the trees how they're supposed to behave. You know, something, you find something where control is part of the thing. But if it's not appropriate, then control is inappropriate. Because if you work for something, technically you are controlled. You're not controlling like that. So unless you're working for a controller by taking responsibility of one area of their control and doing that controlling for them, you know, like a manager of a company, he's controlling, but he's doing it for someone else. You know, so then you have to see, how does it apply? You know, control, okay, in the house, then you control that the children are properly behaved, you control the environment, that it's clean and conducive for, you know, proper Krishna consciousness and human life. Those things there, but beyond that, then you may find the control is not. It's not, it doesn't apply to your situation. You must see that the qualities match the occupation, you know, one's position. Then it's balanced. If it doesn't match, then there's something wrong. Like that. Because otherwise, the living entity, by nature, wants to control, because that's the position of God. So they want to be God in control. But that is what piety means, is that we control our controlling propensity and put it in line with the Lord's directions. Like that. Otherwise, you know, if it was up, you know, each one would be the controller of the universe, you know. Why this universe? You know, we want to control a few universes. You know, like that. But problem is, you know, there's only so much space. It means when you have unlimited living entities in one universe and each one thinks they should be the controller, then you have a problem. So therefore, each one has to agree to control their limited area and be satisfied with that. Then it works. Is that okay? Yeah.
So Maharaj, can you say that if someone is saying to you, whether it's your wife or your friend or devotee, can you say that when they instruct you to do something, could it be said that it's Krishna's view coming through them as an instrument, that this is the best way to go according to the scripture?
Can be. Means we can, no, not necessarily that. You have to contemplate it. You have to see what is the purpose that's coming through. It may be Maya also. You know, so you have to see, according to Guru Sadhu and Shastra, there must be a standard. And then you compare it to the standard. If it's according to the standard,
then you accept it that way.
If it's not, then, you know, it may be an opportunity for you to teach them.
So even though it's coming from the mouth of someone else, whether it's from wife or whatever, we still have to use our intelligence to discriminate whether it's the law.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's why you have intelligence. You have to use your intelligence. Right? It means a child doesn't have, you know, developed intelligence. So they just follow. But as they mature, then more and more they're taught to think and take responsibility for their actions. So then they learn to discriminate. And when they're young, they don't. But as an adult, especially as the head of the family, it's your, you know, duty to discriminate. Like that. It has to be discriminating. But according to Krishna's standard, not our standard. Right? Because if it's our standard, then, you know, who knows how it will be. But if it's Krishna's standard, then it's nice, because then you have to train everybody in Krishna's standard, and you have to follow it yourself and make your decisions according to that. Then with that consistency, everyone will be satisfied. But if it's your standard, then it may be constantly changing according to that, and then who will be satisfied?
So then the standard of the Krishna standard must always be there according to the Guru Dharma Shastra.
Yeah, that's why we hear, we chant, we associate with the voice, so that we know that standard, we hear, we contemplate, we try to apply that standard. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anyone else?
Krishna is the only Purusha.
I mean, Krishna is the only actual enjoyer. Everybody else is either property or enjoyed, or they're an expansion of Krishna, and they're both the enjoyer and servant. Right? Means only Krishna in Vrindavan is the one exclusive enjoyer. Everybody else is servant. Though within the category of servant, then you have differentiation. Some are Supreme Personality of Godhead servant, you know, like Balaram or Vishnu. And some are, you know, and then Shiva's in his own category as Lord and servant, but not Supreme Lord. He's Lord of the material energy, but he's also servant. But the jivas are servants, they're not Lord. So therefore we don't have to guess whether we're supreme and servant, or we are just servants. It's quite straightforward like that. So therefore everything should be connected to him like that, because everything's meant for his enjoyment. So when it's connected to him, then he, being the complete whole, we will be happy. Like that. Both from the, you know, the example given of if you water the root of the tree, all the leaves become satisfied. So that is there. Plus there's the direct aspect of interaction with the Lord, which is then pleasing, because we are people and we need that interaction. Is that okay?
Maharaj, when sometimes you're describing Lord Krishna's pastimes, certain pastimes like his lifting of the golden hill or vanquishing demons, we say that these activities are very wonderful and they're very unique and they're very nice. I was just looking at it from another, I don't know, the thought just occurred from another angle yesterday, I think, on my drive back home from work. How do we see it as a wonderful activity? I mean, I'm taking a material example. We say in materially, you know, people go to the movies and all that, they see something wonderful, or they say a movie is wonderful because the so-called hero in that movie goes against odds stacked against him because he's just an ordinary human being and he overcomes it and therefore it's wonderful. But when it comes in context to Krishna, it's really not surprising. He is the supreme, and for him to do it is really not a major achievement.
No, from that angle, it's not why we're calling it wonderful. What is wonderful is the interaction with the devotees. That's the point. So therefore, that's why you see is that some people will say, how could that be done? How could, you know, a little boy lift Govardhan Hill with his little finger? But that's not the question, because God can do anything. So that's not what's wonderful. What's wonderful is that he's done that for the protection of his devotees, for the interaction with his devotees. That's what makes it wonderful. That's why Krishna's pastimes are considered wonderful, because the interaction with the devotees. Well, Vishnu is also always with devotees, but then there's always the aspect of establishing dharma, you know, correcting the demons, establishing dharma and all that. So that's more like office work, you know. But then the we see that Krishna's interaction with the devotees, that's nice, that's sweet, that's special. So that's the wonderfulness.
Sorry, Mark. A few days ago, you mentioned about that what we desire to get, we cannot get. What we don't want to get, we get it. So, is it what causes it? Because Krishna in the Gita says Krishna fulfills everyone's desire. So why does this happen to us all the time?
Yeah, but that's Krishna fulfilling it. Mm. When then it's his energy, because he is the energy. Mm. So then we're endeavoring for something, we don't get it. Mm. You know, but if Krishna decides, then we get it. Mm. You know, so that's the thing. When the is from our own side. Generally, you see whatever you endeavor for has a tendency to go away. But if they consent, then it works. You know, like a little kid, you see a little kid, they look cute, you want to talk with them or interact with them, but the tendency is they'll shy, they'll move away. So unless they consent, then it's there. But otherwise, the tendency is you go after something, it goes away. So the thing is whatever we're interested in, it's actually Krishna. No, we think it's all these things of this world. So then when he consents, then you get it. But the thing is you'll get it on his terms. You know, we don't necessarily get things on our terms. You know, people got things on their terms. You know, history would be a lot different. But if we study history, generally no one ever gets anything on their terms. You know? You get it on terms of what you deserve. You know, like you take your passbook, go down to the bank, you'd love to draw out $1,000,000, but the teller tells you, you know, you have $20 in the account. So, you know, it doesn't exactly go according to our desire. You know, that's the thing. Here we have unlimited desires that are, you know, unfulfillable.
So that's the analogy of Krishna fulfills everyone's desire.
Means he fulfills everyone's desire, because he's the one that means any desire is fulfilled if it's being fulfilled by him. We're thinking it's by us, but it's Krishna's arranging. Mm-hmm. See, there's different levels of looking at this. The beginning level is because we want to be happy in this world. Therefore, then the first level is anything you want to be happy, turn to God. He's the only one that can actually fulfill your desires. Right? That's the first level. Then the next level then you go to is then we have to fulfill those desires, but the way God would like them to be fulfilled. Right? Rather than how we would want them fulfilled, how God wants them. It means the principle is the same. You know? But how God would want it to be done. You know, I want to get married, so I want to marry that girl. But in actuality, how would God want me to get married? What girl should I marry according to God's direction? You know, like that. Then you go, that's the next stage. And then, you know, then you're doing it through his direction, through his instruction. Like that. It's we make the endeavor. The endeavor is just we desire that, and whatever is within our sphere, we're engaging that. It means our desire is to engage that, so it becomes engaged. like that. So then that takes us up. But eventually then we see is that we should be desiring to please God rather than ourselves. How can we please God? So therefore, since I'm in this situation, I have this conditioned nature, then this conditioned nature should be married. Right? The first one is, I want to get married. Next is, well, according to my position, what would be pleasing to God? So looking at it, you see the conditioned nature is one that should be married. So therefore, then to please God, then according to His direction, I get married. Not, okay, God says I should get married, so I want to marry that one. No. Then we go back to how would He want us to go through it? You know, then you get to the point of, you know, then just, you know, what actually pleases God, which is not so much the needs of the conditioned nature. So we see it goes up through the various degrees of, you know, understanding, realization, and detachment. So it's a gradual process.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Is it too rude to ask of you how you came to meet Srila Prabhupada and how you took up the
program? Not rude, you probably won't get much of an answer. Means, you know, basic, it's just Vridananda Maharaj was traveling and preaching, and so we went to one of his programs, and then we joined his traveling party. And then when we came to India for the Gaur Purnima festival, then at that time, then we saw Srila Prabhupada. But that's basically how it, that would be the essentials. But, other words, I don't know. How much time is there?
How much time do you play?
Oh, okay, sorry. That's right. Shri Prabhupada ki jai, Bhaktivinoda ki jai, Jai Nitya Gaura Prema.